Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and for this episode, I'm very, very happy to have, for the first time, hopefully not the last, the host of one of my favorite comic book podcasts, as well as the writer, editor, and website host of Sketched.com, Mr. David Harper. David, thank you for coming to the show. I really appreciate it. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm doing well myself. How's the weather right now in Alaska?
It's actually really nice. We had like a day last week that got up to 80. Most people think that we're just like constantly dog sledding up here. Global warming has come, and it is, I don't know. I read an article once that said we were going to be Florida in 50 years. Jeez. And I'm starting to believe it because it's getting pretty warm.
Yeah. Everybody who's a fan of nature always talks about Alaska as being like the promised land, where you see
ridiculous.
The most beautiful things that you can't even imagine. So what was it like growing up in Alaska for you? Because you've been there your whole life, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of funny because I'm actually, like, I constantly call myself the worst Alaskan ever, effectively, because I don't like winter. Mm-hmm. I don't like being cold, and yet I live in Alaska. So, I mean, who the hell knows what that means? But I don't know. I mean, it was growing up in Alaska was pretty cool. I mean, you would walk out your house and you'd see a moose. You would have constant access to mountains and water and all kinds of things. And I don't know. I mean, it really is everything that people say it is. It's mm-hmm. like a untouched, unbelievable outdoor wonderland. Unfortunately for me, I'm more of a city boy growing up in a place that is very famously not a city place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very odd how it works out, and yet I'm still here. So what does that mean? I don't know.
Well, Toronto is known for being pretty cold as well for majority of the year. Whenever I'd go down to Florida and visit family, a lot of people would think that every part of Canada is freezing all the time as well. So I get the stigma of how people view Alaska. But you mentioned being a city boy, and listening to your podcast, I know how much of a sports fan you are, but Alaska is the one place where there's no major sports team, and you know everything, it seems, about almost every sport that's happening. So how did you pick your teams growing up that you followed?
So I'm like I've described myself as a free agent fan, and the idea is that my teams, I didn't pick them. They picked me because, okay, so I'll do it really quick. So my three main teams, I also like, you know, other teams and other sports, but my three main teams are the Seattle Mariners, which that one makes sense. It's right. Like the closest city to, or American city to Alaska. I was a kid, right? I collected sports cards, and I started collecting sports cards right when Ken Griffey Jr. was a rookie.
Okay, perfect.
So, yeah, I mean, like, I mean, the kid. I mean, what's cooler than the kid when you're 5 years old? I mean, nothing. And so, I grew up being a Mariners fan. Unfortunately, at this point, like for half my life, they've been horrible. But at the same time, my fandom continues to persevere. I'm a New England Patriots fan, much to many people's chagrin, because my dad grew up near where Drew Bledsoe was from, and he gave me the 1993 SP rookie card of Drew Bledsoe and told me that you're a fan of him now, and I'm like, okay. And I am not still necessarily a huge Drew Bledsoe fan, but I'm still a Patriots fan, so that fandom has continued on from that. And then, lastly, the Indiana Pacers. I watched Reggie Miller score 25 points in the fourth quarter of a playoff game against the New York Knicks, at the end of which he did flash the choke sign at Spike Lee, and I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my entire life. Like, the combination of just being so en fuego in a fourth quarter like that in a playoff game, just, like, going into the Mecca, going into Madison Square Garden and making, like, just tearing it up like that, and then, like, going at Spike Lee, I was just, everything about that, I loved it, and I've been a Pacers fan ever since. So there's like really specific moments in my life that I can tie to my fandom. Oddly, both two of the three are connected to collecting sports cards, a thing that I no longer do, so yeah.
Well, it's usually how it goes, right? There's always that moment where somebody gives you something about that team, whether it's a hat or a jacket, and you connect yourself to that team for life for some reason. But hey,
oh, yeah.
It worked out with the Patriots, right? You got to see a lot of championships won and some pretty great Super Bowl moments with Buddy over there.
Oh, yeah.
Are you going to be interested in what he does with the Bucks, or are you strictly a Patriots, see what Cam Newton does?
I'll be like a person who checks in on his ex on social media, where it's just like, I'm happy that they're happy, but I'm very, very, very happy about the Cam Newton signing. And so I'm like, I've already started thinking about moving in with my new significant other, thinking about nice hats, things of that sort. So yeah, I'm happy for everybody. I mean, also like Brady's in like the best situation possible for him. Beautiful weather, yep. Incredible weapons on that team. I mean, honestly, like if they could have just taken all the weapons from the Bucks and put them on the Patriots, I would have been even more happy. But at the same time, I mean, it seems like it's working out for everybody. I'm glad that the Patriots aren't paying him $30 million a year, but it does bum me out that he's not finishing his career with the Patriots.
Yeah, that's
the only pluses thing. And minuses.
Yeah, that's the only thing that's weird. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just gonna say. When did you grow up? Like, what was your growing up days? Were you like an aughts or like the 90s?
I'm 90s. I'm an 84. That's my year of birth.
Oh, I'm 84 also.
Yeah, there you go. So we have probably a lot of the same reference points to remember sports and collecting. I mean, I remember that era of sports cards and memorabilia being as big as, if not bigger than, comic books. But in Toronto, my youth was very, very much tied to the Blue Jays being the World Series champs for 2 years in a row and the Maple Leafs coming very close a couple times to making it to the Stanley Cup Finals. So our 93 season in Toronto of the Maple Leafs is still something of legend of what could have been.
I love those early 90s Blue Jays teams were awesome.
They were so good. I mean, you don't realize it as a kid because it's just, it's your team, so anybody who's a baseball player is amazing to you. But looking back, and you realize, like, statistically, how they were just running the American League at the time with the first three people in their lineup were like 1, 2, and 3 in averages and all of that stuff. So it was like, wow, what a team we had. You didn't realize it as an 8-year-old necessarily, but yeah, I was happy to see those games and remember those moments, like literally watching Joe Carter hit that home run. Like, yeah. I remember where I was, and I couldn't believe that something like that happened. So cool.
That's one of those moments in sports, though, that you can, like, perfect. I mean, even if you're not a Blue Jays fan, like, I can visualize him running around, the bases after hitting that home run, and he's, like, kind of pumping his arms and everything.
Yeah.
And, like, that's such a perfect moment. I don't know. That's why sports are so amazing. Honestly, it's kind of funny. Like, there's like this weird gap between sports fans and comic fans, but I feel like maybe there's a lot more overlap than they would realize. And I think Absolutely. That it's like the same things that I loved about sports when I was a kid, like Reggie Miller making 8 points in 9 seconds against the Knicks in the playoffs, or, you know, Edgar Martinez hitting a double to win the ALDS series against the Yankees, and like Ken Griffey Jr. running in from first base on that double and things like that. I love those moments for the same reason why I loved like Wolverine having his adamantium taken out by Magneto in X-Men 25. It's like all of the emotion and the drama of the moment. It's just like, you remember those moments. Like, I remember where I was when I read that comic. And it's funny because it's like most of my dominant memories from my youth that weren't like, I don't know, kid stuff were like specific moments relating to sports or comics. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's weird how the brain works.
Yeah, no, I get it. And I mean, you're right. It seems like there's not as many sports fan, like comic book fans who love sports as much as they love comics. I heard you say on one of your recent episodes, and it is true, comic fans and wrestling fans are very similar.
Oh yeah.
I'm not sure. Like, I think it's, it was in that episode that you did. I forgot the author's name now. The one that was about the check, please. The hockey book.
Oh, Ngozi Okazu. Yeah.
Yes. And you guys both mentioned how there is that thing of a uniform, that team aspect of putting on a uniform and doing something spectacular that most humans can't do, that's appealing, that's very similar to, you know, our comic book heroes. And wrestling totally played into that sort of good versus evil, put on this ridiculously lavish suit that you would never wear anywhere else and, you know, fight somebody. So I get it. But yeah, sometimes it's like, how come there isn't more of that sports and comic book meshing? But you know what? There are a few of us. There are a few of us out there. And I enjoy your sports tangents.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I enjoy your sports tangents on your podcast. The one you did with Brandon recently was really cool.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I think that they're part of that lack of overlap is because, like, I swear when I was a kid, like, it was like you either like nerd stuff or you like sports stuff, and I love both of them.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's necessarily the case anymore. I think people just like everything, especially with the fact that, like, comics have infected movies and TV shows and stuff. Now it's like you can love baseball and also Marvel, or you can love basketball and also – I mean, like – my favorite team is the Indiana Pacers, and Victor Oladipo dunked with a Black Panther mask on in the dunk contest in the All-Star game.
Right.
And so there's obviously a lot more overlap than there used to be. It's just, I don't know if we've had that generation of creators where the overlap is more evident, you know?
Right, right. And you, like Dwight Howard as Superman, like there's a lot of crossover stuff if you really want to look for it. And of course, like some of the best, anyone who loves the Avengers and especially the X-Men will always reference those issues where they're playing a sport together. Like those quiet moments after a big event comic where they go back to the mansion and they're just having a softball game. Like, it's perfect. Those are the best issues of X-Men a lot of the time. So, sports and comics. Them. Yeah. So, tell me your origin story for comics. Everybody's got one. Everyone's is a little bit different. What was yours? How did you get into the hobby?
I don't remember specifically. Mm-hmm. The funny thing is I've went over this a lot in my head and also in my writing and stuff like that. But basically the gist is, I think the first thing, I mean, besides like comic strips, I loved like Bloom County and Calvin and Hobbes in particular when I was young. But I think it started with the Transformers Marvel comic. And that was because I loved the Transformers, and I would like do literally anything that took to get more Transformers content. And so I just read like the Marvel ones like crazy. I think a lot of those came from like grab bags and like random like antique stores that I went to with my parents, and they were just like really easy to get. But then it evolved once I got into like the X-Men, and I think that was partially because like the X-Men animated series and also like the old Marvel Universe trading cards. Because of those two and because of Batman, the animated series, I think that was kind of like my gateway into it. Like that combined with the Transformers, Marvel stuff. I think the funny thing though is like, I didn't really think of, and this is weird to say, but I don't know if I even really thought of the Transformers comics as comics. I thought of it as Transformers stuff. And I was just like, I want more Transformers stuff. It could be like little stories in like bazooka wrapper or bazooka gum wrappers, or it could be like anything. And I would read it, and I just thought it was Transformers. But X-Men, I think, is where I really started being like, oh, I think I just like, actually like comics. Even though when I was getting into comics or into the X-Men, it was like the craziest time possible, because it was like Cable was there, and Strife was there, and Strife was a clone of Cable, and all the Legacy virus was going on, and there's all this nonsense, and it was like the most insane stuff ever, but I just loved it. Everything about it was just high drama, and I thought it was fantastic. So from there it evolved. I started reading like Bone, and I got into Preacher, and then I stopped reading comics for a few years, and the comics that got me back on board were Why the Last Man and Fables and The Walking Dead. And since then I've been back on board. I took like a 3-year hiatus, but anyways, it's just kind of evolved from there. I'm always just kind of like picking up new things to read. But it all really started with like Transformers and X-Men. Those are my origin, my gateway points.
Mm-hmm. I love hearing those stories of when people, it seems to happen to all of us where we're really into comics, and then for a couple of years we step away from it for some reason, whether it's us discovering girls or boys and music, and you know, we're kind of too cool for it, but then we always kind of go back to it. What was it, that thing that made you want to go back to comics? Was it just finding Why the Last Man and like, hey, I still like these, or is there something that drew you back to the comic book shop?
Oh no, there was a very specific story about this. I was back, I went to school out of state, and I was back home for the summer, and I was with my mom, and she randomly told me that she would hate that I'm saying this, but whatever, I'm gonna say it anyways, mom. She said that the only thing that ever made her ashamed out of anything that I had done was that I stopped reading comics when she knew I loved it. And she just like couldn't believe that I gave up on something I loved just because, like, in her mind, because like I was worried that people would think I was less because of my love of comics. And she was totally right. I mean, that was absolutely why I did it. I was like concerned that I would have been perceived to be less cool. And so I ended up going to, she said that, you know, to encourage me to get back in, she was like, I'll buy you, you know, a trade paperback. And so we go in there and we go to Bosco's, which is my shop in Anchorage, Alaska. And we walk in, and then one of the clerks comes up and, you know, is like, offering to help. And I was saying I was getting back into comics after a few years, and he was like, okay, what do you like? And I was like, well, the last thing I read was like my favorite comic ever, which it still is, Preacher. And he was like, okay, well, we got some awesome new like Vertigo stuff. And so it was right after the Y trade had just dropped, and right after the Fables, I mean, like shortly after the Fables one had dropped. The timing doesn't work perfectly, but it was somewhere in the range where Why the Last Man and Fables and The Walking Dead's first volumes would have been first coming out. And so I ended up going there. My mom bought me all three trades, and I was like, these are really amazing. And I was totally back on board. And by the time I moved back down to college, I moved with a long box, like completely filled with trade paperbacks that I'd been buying week after week during the summer there. So I was very much on board from the jump.
Around what year was that? When Why the Last Man?
2004?
Okay.
2003, 2004? Yeah, it was probably 2004, I want to say, because I remember I was living in an apartment. Actually, it might have been 2003, because weirdly, I moved with that box of trade paperbacks, and I'm not even kidding. I drove down from Alaska to go to my school, which was in Idaho, and we stopped in Seattle to go watch a Mariners game, and overnight, my car was stolen with everything I owned in it, including all those comics.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
And so, anyways, needless to say, that was a very weird start to the school year, and it made it very memorable that it did happen in 2003.
Where did you go to school out of state? I don't know if you said that.
University of Idaho in Moscow, Idaho, which is like over by Spokane, Washington.
Okay. So were you able to go on the hunt and get all those books back, or were they some of them still missing?
Oh, no. I mean, they were all gone. I mean, I eventually, you know, probably repurchased them over the years. The problem was, is like, you know how it is. It's like if you lost a long box, it's like, I don't know if you'd be able to recall exactly what was in that long box.
Right.
And so I remember there was like a lot of Preacher, and there was like Transmetropolitan and like Why the Last Man and Walking Dead, Fables, etc. And so I eventually got all those back. I have like all those series complete. But there was probably stuff in there that I don't recall, but I don't know. I mean, it was one of those moments at the time that was extremely terrible, but looking back on it, like, you know, it's a thing that happened. And I'm like, it was kind of funny too, because there was like a lot of stuff in there. I was just like, yeah, this is fine. But because insurance, I got like a big check to be able to like rebuy my stuff. And so it was like, I was reinventing myself as a person because of this weird thing that happened to me.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, you can take those bad moments and like the perspective that you had to be able to reinvent yourself, that's a good way to look at it. Just redo it over and kind of curate it even a little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I did with every facet of my life. I mean, like, I'm not kidding, when everything I owned, I was moving into a new apartment and I had nothing down there. And so literally all of my clothes, all of my possessions, all my DVDs, all my possessions, everything was gone. And so I had to rebuild on the fly, and it was like 3 days before school started too. So I was pretty shabby there for a few days.
Yeah. What was that like, being able to go to school out of state where you're growing? Like, I mean, Alaska seems so far removed from the rest of the United States, just when you look at it geographically, and now you're going to school somewhere, you know, away from home. How did that affect you and your sensibilities of how you, you know, took in comics or even just your views of the world?
Well, I mean, the one thing that made a big difference is that, I mean, Alaska, because you're saying Alaska is so far removed from everywhere. There's two things. One, it's like, you don't have the opportunity, if something goes wrong, to like retreat to your family or to your friends that are back in Alaska. Right. And now, granted, I actually went to college with my four best friends, and so that made it really, really easy. But it definitely made it so I was more self-reliant. And I think that was like a really important thing. Mm-hmm. It also helped that, I mean, I'm going to give a big shout out right now to Moscow actually has a great comic shop, Safari Pearl. And it's not just a comic shop, but they're still around. They were where I got back into comics got back into reading single issue comics, because the first comic that got me buying single issues again was Infinite Crisis.
Hmm.
And I actually, you know, I say it was more self-reliant. I actually, like, my Safari Pearl sold out of the fourth issue of that, and it was the first issue I was going to buy to, like, get back into reading single issues. And I was so desperate to get it, I actually bribed my friend who lived in Spokane to go to a comic shop and drive it down to me. And I bribed him with Hawaiian food and beer, I think. So you can tell it was definitely college instead of, you know, current times. But anyways, but yeah, I mean, it just really taught me that I think it just taught me to be independent, like really independent. I'm like, I just kind of do things my own way in every facet of my life. And I think college, more than any of the classes that I took, I went to business school there, and I got 2 degrees in marketing and business management. Well, technically business management and human resources. But anyways, but it taught me to just that, like, trust myself and to be myself. And I think those are two really important things to learn when you're like 18 through 22.
Mm-hmm. That era of comics that you were into, there's something special about that looking back, because you mentioned Infinite Crisis, and that's when, just after Infinite Crisis, I got back into collecting comics, where I had my own full-time job. I had like a steady income, where that disposable income, I could start buying everything, and it was like a good jumping on point, because both Civil War and Infinite Crisis were kind of happening at the same time. What were some of your favorite books of that era? Because I feel like that's the last time I really feel DC was at the top of its game. I could be wrong, but how about for you? What were some of the things you were reading at that time?
I mean, that whole decade's really good for both Marvel and DC, and it really is, everybody. Right? I mean, DC, yeah. Like when you expanded to Vertigo, I mean, you had Why the Last Man, Fable, Scalped was starting up. I mean, 100 Bullets, it was just like loaded. Image, it was like the beginning of The Walking Dead, and there was like a ton of other great books around there. I really think that like, the aughts might be the best decade in comic history.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, that's partially, I think part of it too is like, I think you touched on something, like when you first get back into comics, it's like pure rose colored glasses. You love, like, there's just so much like amazing out there, and you're like kind of discovering everything in a rush. But I mean, Marvel had the Ultimate stuff. I really loved the Ultimate stuff when I was getting back into it. Next Wave is like something that I've like endlessly talked about, although that's slightly less appealing these days. God, I'm trying to think. Really, like, I loved like pretty much all of like what Marvel and DC was doing during that time. Even though I don't necessarily like Civil War is a fun book, but it's not, I don't know if it's necessarily like a great book. It was just a really good a gateway drug. I think that, like, honestly, the thing that is really different between the aughts and this decade, or actually I guess the past decade, is that I feel like Marvel and DC genuinely used events as a way to get readers on board and to discover other stuff. And now it just feels like they do events because that's expected out of them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I mean, I was talking to Jerry Conway one time, and I was asking him about when he was doing Spider-Man, a Sensational Spider-Man, or Spectacular Spider-Man, and he had to figure out a way to do a tie-in for Inferno. And he had mentioned how the worst thing he felt that ever happened to comics were these events, because when it forced people to tie into it, it disrupted whatever story they may have had planned and would make whatever they were doing now tying into this thing be like, well, that wasn't a very great story, but they were forced to tie into Inferno. I liked Inferno as an X-Men story, but when everyone has to play in that sandbox for a little bit, and then now you take that to today, where all of a sudden you're really enjoying, you know, a Miss Marvel book, and then all of a sudden there's some sort of Civil War Part 2 that she has to be a part of, and it's like, man, does she have to be involved in this too? So you're right. There's that sort of like another event that ruins what this creator was doing so good, and now it seems like it's not as good as it was because he's forced that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily like a universal truth or anything like that, but I will say that, like, I feel like basically Civil War to Secret Invasion, like when you look at the tie-in books for Marvel, like they felt more like they felt like jumping on points, and now a lot of times they feel like jumping off points. It's like, granted, it's not nearly the same as it was going to be, but like Empire probably would have turned me off a bunch of books that I really like, because I mean, honestly, I don't really care that much about Empire. But like, you look at Secret Invasion, I mean, honestly, like, did you ever read the Black Panther story that Jason Aaron and Hefty Apollo did in that?
No, I didn't.
It's like a 2-issue story. It is like absolutely amazing. It's basically about T'Challa like protecting Wakanda from an invasion. you know, during like when the scrolls were coming. Actually, if you look at it, if you read it, I would not be the least bit surprised if the scenes in Infinity War that would take place in Wakanda were actually influenced by that, because it is such a, like, I mean, it's like honestly just completely badass. It is a really, really, really good comic. And it shows what you can do if you're coming from a point of like finding a story versus forcing a story, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. Well, hopefully Empire turns out to be something decent. I mean, we kind of have to keep up to speed somewhat, or especially you, with what's happening in comics. How do you keep yourself organized with keeping up to speed with everything that's happening, but also controlling what it is that you're buying and consuming when it comes to like the hobby itself? Because there's collecting and consuming comics, which are kind of the same, but also two very different things. How do you keep that organized for yourself?
I don't.
Me neither. It just feels like books are falling all over me.
Well, no, I mean, it's funny because I used to try to read everything when when I first started writing about comics. I was like one of the first people at Multiversity Comics. I don't know if you know that site.
Yeah.
But like we were like building it up and we were trying to read everything basically and try to talk about everything. And at a certain point, I realized I just can't do that. Like when I'm trying to do, you know, have a life and I'm trying to, you know, once I started sketched and started doing off panel, I realized that like trying to read everything was just ensuring that I was reading a bunch of stuff that I don't particularly like.
Yeah.
And so I much more fine-tuned my stuff. Like I've never read Heroes in Crisis. I haven't read, I don't know if I read a single, I finally read Metal and when it came out on hardcover and I was like, I really wish I hadn't read that.
Yeah, and me neither.
It's just like, I don't know. Like I'm probably not going to read Empire. I am not reading Death Metal. I'll read Ten of Swords because I'm like Hickman for life.
Right.
But I if there's an event that doesn't appeal to me, I just skip it. If there's really any comic that doesn't appeal to me, I just skip it. I mean, it's just like there's – especially at this point when there's so many comics and there's so many different places to read comics. Like a couple weeks ago, I wrote about an amazing comic that Jillian Tamaki wrote for the Virginia Quarterly Review. It was called Ned, and it's a story about a husband and wife who lost their cat. And it's just a phenomenal comic. And it's like never when I was like 12 years old would I think I could just pop on the internet. Well, I mean, I didn't even know what the internet was at that point. But never did I think that I could pop on the internet and just find free comics that were better than like literally anything I was reading.
Right.
And that's just the nature of the world today. So it's like I think that trying to stay up with everything because it's like – I don't know. One of my problems with a lot of like the way that storytelling is approached by fans these days is the fact that they – it's almost like plot is like nourishment. It's like you have to stay on top of this stuff. But plot is not really where the best comics come from. You know, it's storytelling. It's like the ability, like how good the craft is, how compelling the characters are. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, you just got to find what's best for you. And I do that.
Yeah. And you're right. There is so much to choose from so many different avenues, whether it's a webcomic, whether it's, you know, hitting one of these indie shows where you're not going to really find anything from Marvel and DC, but you're going to find some incredible stories that you never thought would become your favorite. So it really is a golden age for comics. Some of the things I like that you do on your show is talking to people in the industry, comic shop owners or people who kind of have their finger on the pulse when it comes to the journalistic side of comics. When and so much of the time there seems like there's always doom and gloom, but there is so much hopefulness in the art form. Like that's not going anywhere, which it makes me very hopeful, which I'm happy about.
Yeah, I mean, there are two different things. I mean, it's like the industry and the medium itself are completely different. It's like maybe the industry will change, but like comics will always be around. Comics always have been around to a certain degree.
Right.
It's just like the industry certainly makes it easier because, you know, it turns out people want to make money from things they do.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, like look at like Kickstarter and Webtoon and, mm-hmm. you know, all kinds of different like book market publishers and everything like that. It's a much broader place than it was when you and I were kids.
Yeah, for sure. And there's so many different ways now that you don't just have to go to a specialized shop to find your books. You can now, you know, do it digitally or have Marvel Unlimited or whatever the case may be. So it is I don't know what the right word is, but it there's a treasure trove of things you can do when it comes to this hobby. What are your thoughts on the, as far as like the industry is concerned? Because you often hear people give their opinion on the single issue or the pamphlet style. And I know that you still buy single issues and have an affinity for them. What are your thoughts on that as part of the medium when it comes to comic books and what it's looking like for the future?
I mean, I think that as long as comic shops are around, single issues will be around. I think that they're a hugely important part of the mechanic. And the thing is like, I know that there's a lot of people who have long said that single issue is going to die, that the comic book form is going away, that graphic novels are the future. Absolutely. Graphic novels are undeniably the present and the future. I mean, they're both. I mean, digital is going to be a much bigger part going forward, especially if DC has its way. But I think that most companies are hesitant to get rid of revenue streams for very obvious reasons. They like making money, and single issues make them money. And the thing is like I talked to Rob Guillory about this when he came on my podcast this past week. When you have a decently successful like single issue series, like we talked about Chew, like it was selling somewhere between 10 and 12,000 issues a month, which most people would be like, oh, that's about cancellation. They were making money off that. And then that leads into trade paperbacks, and then that leads into hardcovers, and then that leads into omnibuses. And when you combine all those, that's when you start making real money off that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so the single issue form is really just chapters in a larger book. And because of that, it's such a potentially profitable platform that I don't know. I mean, I think that anybody that says that they like know for sure that it's going away in like the next 5 years doesn't know what for sure means. And I think that the idea, like, is it possible that they'll be gone in 5 years? Sure, but I doubt it. I mean, like I said, as long as like comic book shops are around, I don't see them going away. I will say though, the problem is single issue comics are not appealing to kids. And right. Like when you look at like the way that kids these days like to engage with stories, they like to binge stuff. And yeah. I think that that's why Webtoon has been so successful. And I think that's why digital like subscription platforms are so successful. You can go on Marvel Unlimited and read every Spider-Man comic ever, basically, for what, $9.99 a month? I mean, that's killer. So it's just, I think it's kind of like with any type of storytelling medium, it's like you have to find different ways to deliver your stories and find the right ones for each demographic. It's not just as simple as like, here's single issues, enjoy that. It's like, what is the right answer for the 15-year-old who loves Spider-Man but doesn't know how to read, like doesn't know how to get into comics? Like, give them a better option. So yeah. I think it's just like single issues will always be there. It just has to be a much smaller part of the pie than it used to be, perhaps.
Yeah. Do you think that the single issue is something that is still catering to the collectors who see value in that moment or that chapter where this thing happens first? Do you think that's where it's still kind of directed to, that aspect of fandom?
Yeah, I mean, to a degree. I think it's that and nostalgia. I mean, like, I largely read single issues not because they're, I mean, honestly, reading graphic novels is better. Reading complete stories is better. Yeah. But I like it because it's the way I've always done it, and I enjoy that aspect of it. So I think it's a mix of nostalgia and the collector element. I mean, that's part of the problem with the numbers getting as low as they are. Like, you can have something like Negan Lives come out, and even though that was a comic that was given away for free to shops, I mean, like, that's something collectors are still going to go after because they see value there. They'll be like, oh, this is a Walking Dead comic that you can only get if you buy it from my eBay store or whatever. And so you can corner markets on books so easily. So
right.
I don't know. I mean, it's really tricky because a lot of the value that is given to comics like Legion of Superheroes #6, where a Gold Lantern first appears, is like a theoretical value.
Mm-hmm.
It like doesn't necessarily actually have any real value. It's just dependent on this current short-term interest. And I kind of feel like everybody is just kind of – it's like the shell games where you're like hiding a ball in cups and you're just trying to like keep people interested in what you're trying to do. But in reality, it's like there's not – it's all perception. There's no real value there. So I don't know. I mean, that's why I think it's problematic as a long-term option.
Yeah.
Everything is dependent on theoretical value or nostalgia, and those are not forever. I mean, the audience will age out. I mean, age out in the sense that, you know, like, I'm a younger reader and I'm 36. That's not good.
Yeah, no, it's true. And you're absolutely right. How do you get new people into new kids? Because you want to get the kids in the door so that they'll be lifelong participants of the hobby, because there's now so many different ways of collecting. Like, I was, as a kid, you know, I loved the single issue. I loved going to the store with my dad, and when he would have to make a milk run, he would buy me a 75, 50 cent comic at the time, and that was great. And we wanted to know, but if we didn't know the full story, we would kind of fill in the rest when we got whatever issue came after, and we would, you know, kind of imagine what happened, and that was part of the fun for us. But now I look at my collection, and it's all trades and omnibus, because I like to do the binge reading as well. But that's from, as a kid, I appreciated a single issue. Whereas Now kids, they don't want that single issue anymore. It's $5, you know, depending on what it is you're getting. It's like, that's a pretty pricey entrance point for a very limited amount of entertainment.
Yeah, but there's plenty of comics for kids. I mean, like, I was just looking at Brian Hibbs's book scan numbers for 2019 on the beat right before we started talking. And I mean, that's, you look at what Dogman's doing. Dogman, like, the number one Dogman release, sold more than 1 million copies just by a book scan. It had even more printed. I mean, if you combine all the, I mean, Dogman probably makes as much as Marvel does. Actually, guarantee you it makes as much as Marvel does. Absolutely. Just that one comic. And it's because kids love those comics. Kids love Raina Telgemeier. Kids love, you know, Gil Galligan's Babysitter's Club comics. There's just all kinds of comics that kids are reading. They're just not reading single issues.
Exactly.
That's what I'm saying, is it's like, discrete audiences want different things, and the direct market would be better off if they didn't try to pretend like everybody wants the same thing, because they don't.
Right. Yeah. And it's true. Like, when my wife brought home, she works in a dental office, and one of the kids gave her Smile to read from Raina Telgemeier, right? And she brought it home, read it on the train. She goes, oh, look, this kid gave me a comic book because they know I like comics. And I knew the name, and I knew how popular that book was. I read it in one sitting. It was fantastic. So, yeah, there's plenty of things and entrance points now for kids to read, but it may not be superheroes, and it might not be, you know, Spider-Man issue 751 anymore. Like, that might not be the way to do it, but you're right. There is plenty of things for them to read, and that is refreshing when you go into a comic shop and you see how many options there are for young readers.
Yeah, and so much of it is good too, which is the really important part.
Yeah, I haven't gotten a chance to read Superman Smashes the Klan, but that looks like a wonderful book.
Yeah, totally. I mean, Jean Luen Yang is amazing, and Gurihiro is an incredible art. Well, are incredible artists, and that trade's not out yet, is it?
It is. Yes, it is out.
It is. That's why I thought, my shop said it wasn't, and I was just like, I know this is out.
Yeah.
Dang you, shop.
Yeah, I went to my shop as well to find it. They ran out of them, but got to put in an order for that, because it looks, I wanted to read it all in one instead of those three separate offerings of it, but it looks fantastic.
Yeah. That's the funny thing, though, is like, one thing that's really cool that's like different these days is, like, so my shop there's only one shop in the city I live in, and so if they don't have it, I'm kind of hosed. But, you know, the last couple of weeks, whenever something wasn't at my shop, I just pop on. I'm friendly with a shop in Oakland, Cape and Cowell Comics, and I just go on to their Comic Hub store. I look and see if they have it, and if they have it, I order it, and it's there within a few days. Perfect. And it's super rad. I mean, it makes it so easy.
Yeah. Are you how much of your reading do you do digitally versus physical?
Very little digital. Most of my digital is Marvel Unlimited, and Marvel Unlimited is really funny. Like, everybody I think probably does this too. Like, there's movies that I own on Apple that I also own on, like, Blu-ray or DVD. And instead of going downstairs to get the Blu-ray, I'll just pop it on, or I'll turn it on, like, Disney Plus or something like that. Like, say if I want to watch Captain America: The Winter Soldier, instead of going downstairs to put it in the Blu-ray, I'll just, like, pop on the digital version, because it's just easier. And that's same thing with Marvel Unlimited. There's times where I'll go back and I'm like, you know what? I feel like reading Fred Van Lent and Hefty Apollo's Taskmaster miniseries from 2010. And I'm like, I could go downstairs and get it because it's literally in a spinner rack in my office, or I could just get on Marvel Unlimited. And so I do that. But besides that, I don't really read a lot digitally. Normally what happens is I'll buy like a million things on DC's Black Friday sale, and then I'll never read any of them.
Right.
which is terrible.
Yeah.
But it's funny how that works.
I do the same. Yeah, I have quite a number of things on my Comixology collection, as well as, you know, Marvel Unlimited. And Marvel Unlimited comes in handy when you want to read something that you can't get your hands on as easily from somebody you might be chatting with. So, I read the Jerry Conway Carnage series that he had done a few years ago, which was really, really good. But I didn't have, at the time, access to get all of it. And it was there, so it's like a perfect way to read an entire series. The only thing is, you're not quite as up to speed on everything when you're waiting for it on Marvel Unlimited. But it's, I don't know, I think the nostalgia factor for me of reading something as a book, it's still, it kind of calms me, as opposed to my, when I read digitally, I feel like there's so many other distractions that I can do on my tablet. Or that are happening while I read. So it's one of those things where I'd almost have to shut down my Wi-Fi to be able to just focus in on whatever it was I was reading, because you always get these alerts and messages. So I'm still preferential for the books, but I definitely see the value in streamlining collections by via digital, your digital collections. So I want to ask you a question that I haven't spoken about with anybody else on the podcast yet. And this year has been quite a mess, just as far as globally, everything that's happening. But even in the comics community, with stuff that's happening with creators, are you able to separate the art from the creator, or is it still too fresh in our minds when we think of some of the things that come out in regards to our favorite creators right now?
Oh, like, am I able to, like, separate the art from the artist, basically?
Yeah. Is that...
It depends. It depends. I mean, honestly, it's like, I mentioned Next Wave earlier. Next Wave is one of my favorite comics ever, but, like, I can't help but feel slightly differently about it because of everything that happened with Warren Ellis. And, you know, I know, like, it's funny how it works. It's like there's certain things that are I'm fine separating the art from the artist. Like, I love Ender's Game, but Orson Scott Card is terrible, and I know that, but I still love Ender's Game, which is weird because, like, Ender's Game shows all this empathy that Orson Scott Card himself does not have.
Right.
Same with Harry Potter. Like, Harry Potter is like a book that's built off of empathy, and apparently J.K. Rowling lacks it herself. But, like, I still love Harry Potter. The weird thing, though, with Warren Ellis, though, is like, I think partially because he was such a crucial, like, when I was getting into writing about comics, one of the most influential things for me is this column that he wrote in 1999-2000 called Coming Alone, and it was, like, my Bible. Like, my copy still has, like, sticky notes in there about, like, just the way he thought about comics and the way he approached stuff, and, like, honestly, like, Next Wave is almost part of my identity at this point. Like, people think of Next Wave, and some people think of me also, because I'm like so obsessively, like, I mean, like, some of it's a gag. Like, some of the stuff that I bring up with Next Wave, I just like to, when a meme pops up on Twitter, I like to incorporate Next Wave into it just for ridiculousness sake. But I mean, it's, I think because it was such a crucial part of everything that I did, that I can't help but feel differently about all of it now. And it's interesting how that works. I don't know. I mean, it's tough. I mean, it's like, these are things that you don't think about. And honestly, another thing is I would say most comic fans don't think about this stuff. Most comic fans, like, if you talk to people in comic shops, there's the internet version of comics, and then the vast majority of everything else has nothing to do with the internet. Most people don't know that DC left Diamond. Most people don't even know what Diamond is. Most people just buy comics.
Right.
And there's different versions of what comics mean depending on how often you're on the internet. And that's one of the interesting things, is because, like, there's all this focus on the comics internet, and it may not have as much of an impact as people think it does. But yeah, anyways, that's not answering your question. But the point is it largely depends, but for some reason this comic stuff is, I mean, it's not for some reason. I mean, just so much of it was terrible. Like, it's hard not to feel different, you know?
Yeah. I've been debating this myself with with friends and some of in Toronto, there's a very large group of people who are comic creators. This is just a city that's filled with them. And you know, some of the people that I'm friends with, I have these conversations with, and how they feel sometimes, how some people may feel about if it was this creator versus this creator, depending on the type of person they were, may affect how they feel about what they did. And there's all of this, you don't want to say controversy about it, but in one way, we've grown up in being 90s kids, especially. We think of all of the type of entertainment. I grew up listening to hip hop a lot growing up. And you think of all of the misogynistic bad behavior that people still listen to. And now our comic book creators are coming out like rock stars, and the sensitivity that we have towards this stuff. It's just a very interesting time to be able, like how we're processing how we interact with our media versus these, you know, this misbehavior that these people have and what it will mean culturally. Because somebody like Warren Ellis, when you really look at his body of work, beyond that, just the influence he had on all of the creators that kind of came up under his tutelage, it's like, man, this is going to be very interesting to see. Like, I'm a big fan of Planetary, The Authority.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's like, is it still something that you can look at as far as seeing the value of how good this is, or is it now tainted?
Well, I mean, the stories don't become less, they just become right. different, you know?
Right.
It's like, Planetary is still an incredibly well-made comic, but it's like your relationship with it changes, right? I mean, it's mm-hmm. like, you're in Toronto, I mean, the Cameron Stewart stuff was like basically right in everybody's backyard,
yeah.
and it seems like a lot of people knew things about that. And like, and that's got to be complicated because it has an area of effect. I mean, especially those two, like Cameron Stewart and Warren Ellis, like those people had huge reach and they went a lot of different places and affect a lot of different people. And like, that's the really tough thing. It's like you read like Shauna Gore's story about like Scott Alley, and it's like, how does that not change how? I mean, the Scott Alley written stuff in the Mignola-verse was already the worst stuff. So it was easy to be like, well, I don't like that even less or even more now.
Right.
But at the same time, it's just, you know, there's such an area of effect. I think that's the problem with all of this, is that comics have always been a place of extreme gatekeeping, and it's been always been a place that's made women feel unwelcome or uncomfortable. And the fact that the people who are so passionate that they made it in were treated like this is just, it's just a tragedy. It's just awful. And I that's the thing that really that bugs me, is just like, they should feel safe and welcome, and instead this stuff happens, and it's just, it's really unfortunate. It's a huge bummer.
Yeah. Do you think there's any redemption for somebody like a Warren Ellis, or is this going to be his legacy in a way?
It's not up to me. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that, I mean, there's plenty of examples of people who are successful after things like this happen, but
yep.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, comics are such a small industry, and
yeah.
I know that some of the stuff that Ellis was up to is already kind of off now. It's like, I don't know if publishers want to hire somebody who has that type of reputation that will immediately earn you a lot of bad press. That's the tricky thing. It's not even
right.
about what they did or didn't do. It's about how it would be perceived in
right.
the public if you did hire them. I mean, look at Image. I mean, like, it's not even Image. Like, Shadowline hired Rock Upchurch to do his own comic, which was, near as I can tell, like a comic about how like a great person was persecuted, which was a really weird angle. But, you know, like that type of stuff is just, like people immediately get on Twitter and just like trash Image for it. And, you know, I mean, you have to, you know, weigh risk rewards. And I mean, I think that there's certainly a potential. I think Cameron Stewart's super done, and I think he should be super done. Do I think Ellis could have a job in the future? Of course. Yeah, sure. And I'm not saying that he shouldn't. I'm not the person who decides that, but I don't know. It's just such a tough and nuanced thing that I honestly, it's just so hard to answer. You know, what do you think?
I go through this, like, this is the thing. Like, you hit the nail on the head as far as the nuance of it is concerned, because we are changing as a culture, and a lot of the things that were people, like you said, people knew about, things were normal, and it seems right now that every week it seems as though there's like a witch hunt going on for everything. And it's not saying that what happened with these gentlemen isn't atrocious behavior, but it's like, where do we go from here? And how do we, you know, when you look at even the things that happen with certain comedians and the opinions or the behaviors that some of them have expressed or things that they have done, at what point are we crossing a line or a point of no return? That's a Bill Cosby line, or a misbehavior and abuse of your influence. Like, is it all the same? And do we treat all of these people the same? Or is there some sort of, like you said, nuance to it in how we go about it? It's tricky.
I'm not trying to like disparage what you said, but I will say, I feel like witch hunt might be a overly negative term for what's happening, because it's just women revealing what happened to them. I mean, it's totally their right to do that. And honestly, sure, it takes great bravery for them to do that. I don't know. I mean, the tricky thing is, when we're talking about people using their influence to, like, you know, change whether or not these people can have jobs, we're also talking about a bunch of people who use their influence to, like, take advantage of these women.
Yeah.
And
no,
so
it's horrible.
I mean, influence is in a lot of ways the problem. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the right answer is. I do think that sometimes, like, things can be, like, I remember I saw somebody on Twitter, Scott Snyder was saying that he was, like, supporting all the victims and everything like that. And somebody was commenting about, like, why haven't you stopped Eddie Berganza and, like, Bob Harris? And I'm like, well, Scott Snyder's not in charge of them. Scott Snyder, right. Like, I don't know. I mean, it's a really tough position to put somebody in. Like, Scott Snyder is not an offender in this situation, and putting him on, like, saying that he's a bad guy because that he's, like, even remotely connected to any of these people, I think is unfair. So I think the thing is like, you can't say that everyone is equal because you believe that they've done something bad. There's certainly far worse people on the spectrum, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the right answer is, and I don't know if there is a right answer, or if we're going to get anywhere close to it. I mean, that's the problem is like, we're in a black and white society where a lot of this stuff is a lot trickier than that. And I don't know if, like, the discussions on the internet will ever get to the point where any real truth is uncovered.
Yes. Yeah. And witch hunt isn't the correct term, because, you know, the fact that women can now say something and be heard is totally a step in the right direction, whereas before that wasn't the case. So to be in a time where that is happening, it is a good thing. It's just like you were saying, you know, we live in black and white, but there's so much more areas that we don't really know the answer to. So I haven't talked about it before. So I wanted to take, because you speak to so many people and you do have your finger on the pulse on a lot of this, I wanted to get your take on it.
Oh yeah. Well, and I will say, I'm not really speaking for anybody else, but I will say that, I mean, the tough thing, the thing that bums me out is, like, I know people that have worked with some of these people, and, like, that has an area of effect on them, and they didn't know any better, you know? Right. And it's like, and that's the tough thing is like, there's such an area of effect with this stuff, and, you know, it's good that it's happening, but it's such like a sprawling, like, I don't know. I mean, honestly, like, when this stuff first started coming up, I was, like, sick, and it was, like, honestly stressing me out to the point where it was, like, mm-hmm. starting to break me. Mm-hmm. And everything was just kind of stressing me out, but at the same time, it's just, like, it was really heartbreaking. It was a heartbreaking week, and, you know, it's continued onwards to a degree, but that week where it was, like, Ellis and Stewart and everybody else, I was just like, Jesus Christ. I mean, sorry. You know,
no.
It's just, like, it was really, I don't know.
Yeah, I feel you.
I'm not remotely one of the most affected people by this, but it was still, like, it was still a lot. And I don't know. I mean, I hate, honestly, I'm not a huge fan of, like, it's tough to really capture nuance in podcast form, in my opinion, because it's so free flowing. And so, I don't know.
No,
yeah.
Fair enough. I appreciate your honesty. That's all you can ask for. So let's not end on a sour note. Let's talk about some of your favorite things that you can think of in 2020. What are some of the things that you've enjoyed when it comes to comics, and some of the things you're looking forward to?
My favorite comics this year, thankfully, I actually just did something like where I covered this. Dragon Hoops is my favorite comic from this year. It was the Gene Luen Yang graphic novel about him following the Bishop of Doubt Dragons, a high school team in Northern California in like the Bay Area, as they were trying to win the title for California, the California State Championships. So he had no interest in basketball. So it was really interesting. It's part like history book, part telling the story of this team as they were going for the title. And it's like really interesting too, because like one of the players on it was a recent NBA player. And so it's like, it's just a real, I mean, Gene Luen Yang is a certified genius when it comes to comics. And I think this is his best book yet. I'm slightly biased because I really love basketball, but it's just great. My favorite single issue series is Dollhouse Family from Mike Carey and Peter Gross. It's a Hill House book, Hill House Black Label for DC. And it's like a horror book, but it's also in the same vein of everything for Mike Carey and Peter Gross. It's like very deeply personal and, you know, about family and about like relationships and everything and about personal history. It's really great. I was blown away by it, but I'm like a super fanboy of Mike and Peter. So that makes it easy. Other stuff. I read Old Head last night, which is another basketball book. It's about a former NBA player who discovers that he's from a family of vampire hunters, and it's about them fighting Dracula, basically. And it's by Kyle Starks. It was a Kickstarter book, and it is absolutely hilarious. It has the single funniest moment in comic book history, in my opinion. It was hilarious. I put it up on Instagram, and I don't think anybody understood why it's funny, but it's like, I feel like if you're a basketball fan, you would probably appreciate it. Mortal Hulk, Kaiju Max. Kaiju Max is my eternal love. Xander Cannon's book. X-Men. I mean, the Hickman stuff is just absolutely brilliant. I don't know. There's a ton. Another one of my favorite books is Check Please by Ngozi Okazu. That book is about food and sports, which is like a perfect combination for me. And it's like a very personal, like, I don't know. It's a very personal story you follow as you read about Biddy, the main character, and his life story over college. Those are some of the top ones. I mean, there's just a lot of great stuff, even though this has been a really wild year because it's, you know, comics kind of stopped for a month and a half.
Yeah. Well, that's good. It's always good to, I always appreciate your lists, your year end lists, and the positivity you bring. I'm a big fan of the podcast, and you keep me a lot of company while I'm at work. I work in construction, so I pop in the headphones and I go through a lot of the off panel episodes, and I really appreciate the stuff that you're doing. It's good stuff.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for your time for today. I know that you are busy at work and planning for future podcasts. What are some of the things that we can look forward to coming up on your show?
Well, the next two episodes I have are Robert Kirkman's coming on. He's been on before, but this time we're going to be talking about Negan Lives and Firepower and just kind of why he's doing the things that he's doing. I just think that he's such a tremendous force for good when it comes to supporting comic shops that I'm really excited to talk to him about that stuff. And then also talking with John Jackson Miller. I don't know if you have you ever been to Comicron? Comicron.com.
No.
He's the guy who runs this site that basically tracks all of comic sales throughout history. And he's been kind of working in varying capacities in comics for I think like 30 years. And so he's going to come on just to talk about like where the direct market is and everything like that. Cool. And I don't know what else is coming up the down the path from there. I normally try to schedule like 2 or 3 weeks out.
Mm-hmm.
And I am currently at the very limit. So I gotta get booking people, Eric.
You gotta do it. I'm looking forward to it. I'm sure it's gonna be great. I hope you and your wife stay safe up there in Alaska, and I hope we get to do this again. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, take care.